Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today's Tuesday. It's June 16th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We've got a very interesting guest today. His name is Dennis Richmond, Jr. He's an author, just became an author, a first, so this is his first work. And he's also someone that promotes different schools, universities around the nation. It's an operation that he calls New York, New Jersey Historically Black Colleges and Universities Initiative. So we're going to speak to him this morning. Bear with me a moment. I've got so many pages open up. I see he's already here. So good morning, sir. How are you? Congratulations.
Thank you so much. How are you? I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me today.
I'm so excited about what you've accomplished. I'm just like in shock. First of all, how did you find the time, the effort, the patience, the compassion, and the passion to write this work, this new book called He Spoke at My School, An Educational Journey? How'd you do that? Where'd you find it?
It's interesting because I actually started this months ago. However, with the whole, you know, COVID-19 pandemic going on, I decided that now I had downtime to actually complete it. So that's what I did. And the book would not have been created had it not been for so many benevolent people. There were a lot of people who allowed me to speak in their school. And as a result, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of students across the country have heard me speak before. And, you know, I've been blessed in the fact that with all of that, I said I might as well write a book about it, and I'm glad that it's done, and I'm glad that people are interested in it.
Well, you know what's so exciting is that actually I had no idea that COVID-19 would have such an impact, and a positive one at that. So, I mean, so COVID-19 got you to work.
Definitely, COVID-19 got me to work.
Unbelievable. Whereas everybody else was pushed out of work, you got into it. So how did you originally got started in this journey about this educational journey? And what captivated you about it? What are you trying? What journey do you want people to come and join you on?
You know, it's crazy because, you know, there's my educational journey, which started since I was a child at home of, yeah, you know, my family teaching me things that children should be taught, you know, always tell the truth and try your best, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's the journey of me in school, elementary school, middle school, high school, undergrad, graduate school. And then there's the journey of me actually going around speaking at schools. And that journey was in 2013, more serious in 2014, when I spoke at one particular high school, and I thought, you know, that went pretty good. I know that I can inspire people. I wonder if I can do this at another school. And I reached out to a few schools, and I spoke at one, and students gravitated to me, and the rest is history. So the journey that I would like those to follow me on who are reading the book is the journey of a young man from New York, a young black man from New York, and seeing the world from my eyes, and then the lessons that I learned along the way that you would hope people pick up as an adult, such as the fact that not everyone with you in certain parts of your life are going to continue to be with you for the rest of your life. And lessons such as hard work pays off. And even though some people might look better than you, they might dress better than you, they might speak better than you, if you work hard enough, then people gravitate to someone who puts in work. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, look, I know that this one might dress a little bit better than him, but, you know, if Dennis is on it, then it's going to get done, and it's going to get done before the deadline. And it's so just things that I've learned along the way that I hope to teach to those who haven't quite picked it up yet.
So was that the burgeoning aspect that brought about the New York, New Jersey Historically Black Colleges and Universities Initiative that you put together? Is that what you spoke to the different high schools about, high school students?
Definitely, and I let them know as well that there are so many collegiate options in this country. So I would hate for students to just apply to schools that are in New York, or more specifically where I'm from, just in Yonkers because you don't have to be tied down to your city. And there are so many young adults who might not travel during the summer on vacations, but they can travel to go to back and forth to school, which is something that I was able to do and so many people that I know were able to do, because even if you take the train 2 hours to your school and then, you know, you come back 2 hours from your school for a holiday or a spring break or something like that, it gives you the ability to learn how to travel, the ability to meet other people. Not to mention, there's a freedom in being able to move across the country, and who wouldn't, especially in this era, want to be free?
So, well, absolutely, it's a key word, but it seems like it's a word that we all know, but evidently we don't all live it. So, and who knows if it really is free? So we'll have to find out. I think we're immersed right now in that dialogue. Hopefully, it'll lead to something. Well, the big question in my mind has always been is, what is it about the black colleges and universities that is really unknown to a lot of people? And is there a reluctance to enter the black colleges? And why would that be? Is it just an issue of ignorance, unawareness, not knowing? You know,
right.
How do people look at them?
Definitely. You know, in my new book, He Spoke of My School, An Educational Journey, I talk about historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs. And a lot of people might not be aware of the fact that these institutions did not come about because there were a lot of black people who said, we don't want to be around white people. These institutions came about because there were thousands of black people. We know at the end of the Civil War, there were 4 million, some sources say 4 million black people who had become free who wanted to go to school. And majority of schools in the country at that time said, well, sorry, you can't come here. And if they said, sorry, that was a nice way of saying it. So they said, we'll make our own institution. So they had bake sales. They had fundraisers. Mm-hmm. They would pick cotton and pull tobacco, and they would sell these products at local markets, and they would raise money and then take the skills they had coming out of slavery, carpentry, stonemasonry, and build schools from the ground up. They built churches and they built schools. So then you would have these schools being built. You would have benevolent white donors who would help build these schools, who came from New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and they would assist, and then these schools would thrive. Now, another lesson known fact is that during the 1940s, when there were many people in the Jewish community who were being persecuted, it was actually historically black colleges and universities that opened their doors for Jewish professors to teach. And a lot of people don't know that. So whereas a lot of schools across the country that did not allow black students said, you know what, we don't want Jewish people here, it was the HBCUs who said, not only do we accept people, but we will welcome you to teach at our school. There's a person who's very well known by the name of Albert Einstein, and it has been said in some sources that he, you know, he's only given so many lectures at so many colleges, yet he taught a at an HBCU. He taught a class at a black college. He taught black students. So there's a generation of black youth who learned from Albert Einstein. So when we understand these schools, one of the big reasons why people might be a little reluctant to go is because there are none in New York, there are none in New Jersey, there are none in Connecticut. Some of our closest HBCUs are in Pennsylvania, in Washington, D.C., and Delaware. So one, there's a lot of students who are scared of out-of-state tuition, rightfully so. And two, there are a lot of students who don't have the opportunity to travel to schools unless they're in New York. So it's sort of a fear of the unknown.
Uh-huh. And so what does it take to overcome this gap between a reality and unawareness? How do you bridge that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We bridge that by having college counselors and guidance counselors in schools reach out to representatives from other schools. HBCU representatives from the 101 HBCUs that are left And I say left because many have had to close their doors due to a lack of enrollment and a lack of funding, are open to coming to New York and New Jersey and Connecticut to speak to students about their institution to recruit them. But there's a lot of guidance counselors who are unaware about these institutions, so they don't even reach out to the schools. So that's another big reason why I said, well, look, if that's not going on, then I'll personally reach out to these schools, and I'll get the brochures and the pamphlets, the pens and the pencils, the hats and the book bags, and I will personally come to your school free of charge and talk to your students and bring them everything that they need. It's one thing when a student goes to a college fair and then you speak to a college representative, but I'm bringing you all of the materials, and I'm speaking to you for 45 minutes to an hour, and I'm showing you a 10-minute college documentary that I put together, sure that you have at least an inkling of knowledge when it comes to this topic. So to answer that question, guidance counselors and college counselors need to reach out to different people.
Well, that's always the issue, but then some people become complacent, or they're too comfortable where they are, so they don't keep exploring, which is like it's a death knell, actually, mentally, if not any other way. So what was it about, I guess, your experience that had you recognized that these schools were there and they could help you and they could help other people? And so what was your intent then, just to be able to give more people of color an opportunity to get a higher education in places that they may not have ever before considered?
Definitely. Coming out of Yonkers, New York, you know, I have a family that did a remarkable job, a tremendous job, a fantastic job of preparing me for the world and allowing me the opportunity to not only understand but fully comprehend who I am and my history. I know my father's side of the family's history going back to the 1700s. I know my mother's side of the family's history going back to the early 1800s. So unfortunately, in a place like Yonkers, New York, where so many young people of color, so many young black girls and boys don't have that knowledge and don't have a knowledge like a Harlem, New York, or a Brooklyn, New York, where even if you're outside, you're around culture somewhere because there's Harlem Hospital and there's a Schomburg Center or there's the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, there's no subway system, no mass transit in Yonkers. So there's a lot of students who didn't get that, not to mention we're in the city in New York that desegregated after South Carolina, Mississippi, and Alabama. So when you put all of that together, and then I go to school out of state and not only learn the value of hard work through education when you aren't in your comfort zone, but then I'm actually being awarded scholarships while I'm a college student and networking with people from across the country while I'm away at school, and learning from such a diverse group of professors who are from all of these different parts of the world, and then I come back to Yonkers and it's still the same. I felt like it was my duty to do something. I had to. I saw that everything was the same. The same people were doing the same things, and I thought, no, that's not what it is. And then some people would say, you know, oh, well, you know, leave. It is what it is. But no, that it can't be that. You know, so I had learned so much in the times that I would go away to school that when I would come back for different house breaks, I would have to try and assist and teach and let students know there's another way. And, you know, we don't all have to go to this local community college and then either graduate in 2 years or drop out and stop. Like, there are other ways to do this.
Is that really what you found, that people in Yonkers don't really know the options that they have in life, and that they truncate their potential because they are unaware? So in a sense, you're opening up a new world for them.
Most definitely. And there's a beautiful spoiler alert in the back of the book, He Spoke of My School and Educational Journey. There are some testimonials from students. And I think one of the most powerful is a young girl who is attending class in university, the school that I had attended, the HBCU in South Carolina, Orangeburg, South Carolina, who mm-hmm. not only heard me speak, but is attending that school now because of the fact that I provided her with the necessary materials and resources to go. There are students who can say that I've assisted them in their scholarship process and in their college essay process and making sure that they can, you know, they have their FAFSA guide so they understand how their federal, you know, all of these applications work online. So, yes, it's a lack of knowledge. And, you know, I don't know if it's from a biblical scripture or if it's a saying, but, you know, the people would perish because of a lack of knowledge. And there, in the world that we live in today, there should be no such thing as a lack of knowledge. You know, knowledge is free. You can go right online and look it up. And if you don't have a phone, there are public libraries. You can find it. There are books. So it's me doing my part to teach in a community where even though it's in New York, even though it's so close to New York City, so close to Manhattan, it seems as though it is still so far removed from the 21st century in so many aspects. And, you know, I don't know. Like,
yeah,
I know about where you're from, but, you know, Yonkers is its own little enclave.
Well, definitely. I remember once needing to travel to Newark, New Jersey. It was a business trip. I was going to the airport. And what was interesting is that when I was coming back, taking the PASS train back, there were some young guys there and that were in front of me. And they said something to the effect of they had no interest to go to see the Empire State Building. And I'm saying, the whole world comes to see the Empire State Building and you have no interest? I was talking to myself. I said, I just couldn't believe that people would be so dense. But I guess maybe they feel comfortable in their own world, even though their world may not be a comfortable place. But that's maybe all they know, so they feel that way. Well, there was a change in attitude in America to some extent, not a full extent, but to some extent when there was an effort, or it seemingly so, I don't know if it became really well-founded effort, to try to get more people of color a better education, to give them placement in different schools. This was going back probably to the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and 80s, and yet we haven't evolved very much beyond that. And what is the cause of that? Is that institutional issues that confront our educational system? Is that endemic to a population of people of color? Is it socioeconomic? Do we really yet understand what causes this? And that people don't are excelling. Yet there are thousands and thousands of people across the nation who are of color who are doing exceptionally well.
Right.
And they're not second banana to anybody.
No, definitely. I think that a lot of it is systemic. I think a lot of it has to do with networking. And I think a lot of it has to do with being in the right place at the right time. You know, often in the Black community, we feel as if there's only a lot of us, not all of us, but a lot of us feel as if the only things we can do is either dribble a ball or make music. And unfortunately, a lot of us fall victim to that mindset. And we think that even at 35, 40, 50 years old, it's still going to come true and there's no backup plan. So those of us who are excelling and succeeding are doing so not just because of a collegiate education, but because we knew someone to get somewhere. We worked hard in a particular place that allowed us to move up. Because even today, there are people of color, not just Black people, but people of color, who have been working at companies for 10, 15, 20 years and have never moved up the ladder because the companies won't allow them to. There are women who have never been able to get that pay raise because their company won't give it to them. So I think that a lot of it has to do with opportunity, and that's why you have different grant programs and different federal programs and state programs to try to give people opportunity. But even with all of the option for opportunity, there has to be some sort of sense for that person to want to do better, if that makes sense. So what
we're on, there are a lot of people. But what germinates that interest? Because yeah, I also hear that a lot of people in the who are of color think they're going to be able to make it as basketball players or some other sports hero, whether, I guess, in baseball, or maybe there are other things as well. I don't know all the sports fields, but then but that doesn't work out, does it? Because how many people who are going to be playing football, even in football in high school here in Yonkers, are going to make it to the top leagues? You know,
right.
I have no idea even how many different teams are out there across the nation. But at the top end of the game, where maybe the people are making $500,000 or $1 million a year or more, that is so breathtaking. I don't know how many people earn that. So why isn't there a plan B? And why isn't that part of the, the beat that goes on in people of colored communities?
Right. You know,
why don't they see that there are other options? How about becoming a doctor, becoming a lawyer, becoming a nurse? Not in their mind?
Yeah, so much of it is opportunity and based on what you see. So if I'm growing up in Yonkers and I'm on Ludlow, I'm on Ravine, I'm on Highland, I'm on Lake, and I'm in these places, and all I know is that there are people around me who are in sports culture and music culture, more specifically rap, hip-hop culture, then that's what I want to aspire to be. You know, that's what I see on TV. They're the ones with the money. They're the ones with the fancy cars. They're the ones with the fancy clothes. I want that. That's what I want. Whereas other communities say, only can you be a musician if you want to, but your father was a doctor, or your uncle was a lawyer, or your grandmother was a daycare owner. So when you're in communities and families of people who have been in occupations, you know that it's obtainable, because you can hear Uncle Joe say, well, when I went to Harvard, or when I went to Mercy College, or when I graduated from Sarah Lawrence, we did this. But if all you hear is, well, you know, in order to make it, you have to be able to play sports, or you have to be able to rap, or you have to be able to sing, then that's all you know. And what makes it so crazy is that people don't understand those occupations are beautiful, but all of those people take people from about 10 other occupations to make them work. For an example, when you're in the music industry, in order to sample other songs, you need licenses. You need lawyers to handle situations like that. So musicians have lawyers, because musicians get sued all the time. So musicians have lawyers. Right. Your singers, your dancers, they have makeup artists. They have producers of their television shows. They have people who are their home designers. So there's many other occupations. You know, you have to have doctors on call, respiratory therapists on call, people in the medical field on call. So that way, when you sprain your ankle during a game, you have somebody there, you know, who can tell you what's going on. So there are so many ways to get around the glitz and the glam and still be in it, based on your occupation. And I think we need to make sure that students know that it's not just about being the star. You can be the one who the star relies on, because I think a lot of us would agree that if it weren't for a lot of lawyers, there'd be a lot of celebrities in jail right now.
Well, and then so why, who's not giving out the message? Is that a message that needs to be heard at home, or validated at home? Is it being heard in schools? Is anything changing, or are we stuck in the same place? And is there a way, for example, for a city like Yonkers, it's the fourth largest city in the state, over 200,000 people, and I think you describe it poignantly but correctly. And so, how do we change that, or can we change it? And what are we holding on to in a city like Yonkers that is so compelling when we see just to our south probably one of the biggest, most developed place in the world? You know, there are not that many places that can challenge New York. I mean, yeah, you've got places like Berlin and Paris and London and probably Beijing as well. But, I mean, you know, this is monumental. New York is monumental. It's a magnet for everybody.
Right.
So
no, it's true. People love
it. There?
Want to come here. You know, New York is arguably the most imitated place in the world, if not one of them.
Yeah.
You know, there's an attitude about and a slang about it. You know, people gravitate to it. So with the question being who's not given the information, I'd say it falls on everyone. It's important for the families to give the information. It's important for the educators in the classroom to give the information. And there's a study that shows when students have teachers of color, more specifically black men, all students improve in school who have that person, not just black students, but Asian girls and boys, Indian girls and boys, white girls and boys. So when you look at the education system and see that there are in some areas 1.9 and in some areas 2% of schools where there are black men, then you have to realize, wait a minute, how is it that you have so many black and Latino boys and girls in school, but yet you don't have that many black and Latino women or men teaching them? So it also comes
Wait a minute. Well, but before you make a conclusion, though, is are there a lot of black and Latino teachers out there? And then why don't they seek employment in the city of Yonkers?
And the thing with that would be if there are a lot of black and Latino teachers out there, one, can they get into a city like Yonkers to teach? And two,
Why couldn't they?
I don't know. Because the fact that black and Latino men.
Are you inferring that they can't?
I'm not referring that just for Yonkers. I'm saying that across the country there aren't enough. If Yonkers put out a call right now and said we need more black and Latino men, it's not to say that there are 15 vacancies open. You know, in education, majority of teachers don't teach for 1 or 2 years and then leave. This is a career. So there have to be spots open for them to come in. So the question
But the point is, for whatever reason in the past, and we haven't had people who have gravitated towards education who happen to be of color, however, whatever the differences are ethnically or some other way. But the bottom line is, and where do you get these teachers? And I can't imagine that people are retiring
right.
in the teaching profession. This is not necessarily a young profession. I mean, there are always new people coming in, but it's a constant turnover. So you could have people retiring within 5 years of whatever. Where are the replacements? So do we have a population of replacements? Or we're just talking, we hope that it'll happen, but we don't have it yet.
And that's why you have initiatives like the My Brother's Keeper initiative, where they have a top two program, a program that I came out of, where not only do you find young men of color and young women of color who want to teach, you also give them the tools that they need in order to get their degree and their certification to go into the classroom. So as
what is the degree and what is it that you teach them to get?
In my experience, it's a Master of Science in Education, and it's me within the next few weeks getting my certification to teach grades 1 through 6. So it's letting students know education is, despite everything that goes on in that field, it is a career that one should want to get into, and it is one that does pay for itself in the long run. So with programs like that, though, to answer your question, it's letting students know that there are options out there for you, and there's financial assistance for you to go to school. Because majority of teachers in this country are certified and have a master's degree. And you can't talk to someone who just graduated with an undergraduate degree who has $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt, hey, go to school again and take out more loans. So there has to be something in place if you want retention in a certain career field to make it attractive. So it's programs.
Yeah, except
it's
you're mentioning, you know, you took both sides. You're saying, though, that there are scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
It's, right now, it seems the only thing that's stopping is the fact that people may not be aware or
mm-hmm.
they're not interested in the teaching profession. So how does one change that dynamic? I can talk a good game and I can come up with a million words as well, but it doesn't explain to me, and I'm not challenging you,
doesn't explain to me
how we're going to change the dynamic. Because right now it's rotting from the bottom up and from the top down. I don't
mm-hmm.
understand. Because no, I don't come from Yonkers, and no, I'm not even born here. So the questions, and I don't understand this. But this is so antithetical to what I know. It just blows my mind.
Right.
What's happening, and I don't have all this bigotry that I see in this country. It just doesn't exist for me. But then I guess my parents, who came from bigoted places, also knew how to change the dynamic for me. So I learned from kids who didn't even have parents, you know, didn't have a clue, you know, about anything or and had nobody there to even, you know, hook up to and to be guided by. So whatever they came up with. So, you know, it's just so interesting. I don't understand where the dysfunction lays. Is it
right.
societal dysfunction? Is it the society that thwarts people from getting an education, from promoting an education? You know, one thing, I don't know if you realize, in the city of Yonkers, going to the Yonkers public school, maybe when you went to the public school, it was different. You know, today, all you have to do is show up for breakfast and lunch, and they don't even care if you show up for breakfast or lunch, but they really would prefer that. Not because they want to feed you, because they make money off of it. But at the end, even if you don't attend class, they move you up to the next grade. And they keep moving you and moving you and moving you and moving you up until you graduate. And then you fall down and you've got nothing. So
wow.
we are perpetuating people who don't have an option in life, have no education. Maybe they are thinking they'll dribble their way to success or sing their way to success or become some football star or whatever. But most people don't. And so this is one of the problems. I don't know how to change that dynamic. And we always talk a good game about the city of Yonkers and its Board of Education. Maybe they should extract education from the board part, and then maybe we'll get somewhere. I don't know.
You know, it's
so
interesting.
I'm appalled.
Yeah, when you talk about talking a good game, you know, and I'm sure that you would agree in this, you know, there's evidence and, you know, you can say things for both sides. You can say, you know, here's why it is going to work and here's why it isn't going to work. And I think it all just comes down to more conversations about it. And I know that's sort of, you know, some would call that cliche or nuance, but I think people really need to have conversations like this. You know, people need to talk about
it. That's the whole point.
And ask.
Well, that's the whole point. If we knew some numbers, then we could come up with a conclusion of what may be going wrong and what may not be going wrong.
Right,
I was like in shock when a couple of months ago, the Board of Education and the Yonkers Public Schools said that they had increased their standards of excellence because 35% of the people in the schools were proficient in both English language arts, which is English, and then math. So that meant to me immediately, maybe I was one of the first because I wrote about it, 35% proficiency means that 65% are not proficient. And then when I looked at the charter school of excellence in Yonkers, they were 92.7 in math and 97.5 in English. So what are we doing? I don't get it.
And I don't know.
What's interesting is that you have a larger diversity of student population in the charter school, and this whole concept of they just pick the best of the best, that's not right, because everybody can apply and everybody can get in. The only thing that they demand is that parents are involved and make sure that their kids do the work so that they're prepared for the next day.
Hmm.
So maybe that's part of the attitude problem. We don't have people who can be engaged. We also have a lot of people I know that of color who may be single parents. So one of them is going to work. There is no second. Grandma and grandpa are taking care of the kids. They don't always have the capacity to do so.
I mean, you know, what's interesting about that,
Hezzy?
Yeah, you know, and again, conversations. I think it's so many, you know, there's so many directions that conversation can go into. And, you know, I think the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of issues and we need solutions. And I don't think anyone could really provide actionable items to make solutions. You know,
Then how do we move beyond status, you know, our stasis right now? So we're stuck. We're just stuck.
Right.
And as a society, not you or I or anybody else in particular, but the system is stuck in where it is and it can't get out of its own way. So how do you change that dynamic? Or is it maybe because, like, you're reaching out to a population of more than one, so it's not a one-to-one thing, but you're reaching out to classrooms and students, and they're not enough of you?
But, I think the question would be, too, you know, you said that there are a lot of single parents, you know, in communities of color. I think the question is, why is that?
It's economic. Everything is economic. That's the baseline.
And, yeah, and then
everything.
That goes back to systematic oppression. You know, why is it that there are communities of color in New York, in Yonkers, black communities, where there's only a mom and there's not a dad? Or there's only grandma and the parents aren't there? And I think
Do you know why? What's the reason that there's only one parent and mom and the children are there? And there is no dad. What happened?
One of the big reasons is that there hasn't been. You compare communities of color to other communities because communities of color have their own issues. For an example, when you look at black families, you can't compare them to white families because since the dawn of time in this country with black families, there was no such thing as a black family because black people were stolen and brought here to work. So
mm-hmm.
when you have that dynamic, there is no family because you can be sold at any time. So 1865, the Emancipation Proclamation, black people are free. There's still never been a black family per se. In the black community, it's always it takes a village to raise a child. Grandma might take care of you. Uncle Joe might take care of you. Aunt Maddie might take care of you. So I don't think we can look at single parenthood as an issue because you have some single mothers who are doing the damn thing, you know, who make sure that their children are doing what they have to do. I think a lot of the responsibility falls on things that are systemic, such as having people teach children who are frightened of those children. You can't teach children if you're scared of them. I truly believe you cannot teach children if you're afraid of them. You can't teach people who scare you. And I've seen it in my own educational experience. Teachers who try to teach who are frightened of students and after school who will walk on the other side of the street so they don't have to look at students or say anything to students. Or teachers you'll see in public
really?
Who don't want to students. Really? Yes. And I've seen it right here in Yonkers. So I think
wow.
that though it is nice to just be able to say, okay, it's A, B, and C. Everything has a gray area, and the gray area is such where there are systemic things and reasons as to why everything is the way it is for black people in this country. And no, that's not to say black people should play victim, but that is to say that we have to realize and society has to realize we have been victimized and still continue to be victimized. You know, you don't get a Dennis Richards
Jr. Why the silence? So why the silence? It's not that people have to be, I don't know, just muzzled. You know, I mean, this is, you could basically get your word out. Look, we're doing a broadcast with you, and why not? We don't censor anybody.
But see, that's because you're open to that. You have a lot of people who don't want to have these conversations because they're challenging conversations, and people don't want to do that because it's so much easier to just say, this is what I think. I'm only going to engage people in conversations who think the way that I do, and that's why nothing changes.
Mm-hmm.
So even it's the same.
You
got to
evolve, otherwise it's going nowhere.
Yeah, the same people who don't want to see black people succeed in this country are the same people who are still promoting Jewish stereotypes. It's a small group of people who hold on to old 1920s, 30s values and views, and they think that's what it is, and they think that America is going to go back to 100 years ago when you can call people out of their name and say whatever you want to certain people and nothing happens, but that's never coming back. And I think the challenge today is having to grapple, for a lot of people, having to grapple with that idea that that's over. You know, and I bring up members of the Jewish community and I bring up members of the Latino community because all too often it's those communities who are still in 2020 getting stereotypes. Oh, they act like this because they're from there. Oh, well, you know, they're this, so they act like that. And that's not what we do. So to bring it back to what you were saying, you know, what we know the issues, but if I had to suggest a solution, I would say one big solution would be to have conversations like this. And the next solution would be to educate children. But how many teachers do you know who are not of color who would be comfortable having a conversation like this with a classroom full of students who are of color, especially if the students are from Yonkers or from Mount Vernon and the teachers live somewhere up in Scarsdale and Mamaroneck or Pound Ridge or Rye?
To the Board of Education, or maybe they're not hiring the teachers that are there that are of color. And there's no reason to get them from Pound Ridge if you can get them from New York City or from other places in the area. Aren't there people who graduate and become teachers who actually graduate from Yonkers? There is no college in Yonkers, but I mean, do they graduate and they are from Yonkers and they would consider coming back and teaching? Are we giving them jobs? I don't understand why we wouldn't.
That would be a question for the person who does that.
Oh, yeah, well, evidently they're not doing it. But, you know, he's Hispanic, and, you know, so what? I guess they can get away with whatever they want to get away with. You know, I'm just in shock. Well, anyway, the Jewish experience is completely different. I guess every experience is different, and every individual experience is different. But, you know, this is the same tropes that are thrown at Jews have been going on for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so way before even the slave trade, you know, began through Europe. And well, that was it. I think they started the slave trade probably in the 1500s, 1600s. And a lot of people don't even understand how slavery began or where it began and who sold who to whom and how it all became part of the reality. Maybe that's the problem, too. We have so much ignorance that it is so hard to even tell people or share these concepts because they don't get it.
But see,
they don't go back enough.
Yeah, and you have to remember that, too. People don't want to talk about history where they are the one oppressing other people. So if it were, you know, white people who and I'm talking, you know, white people who came from England and Germany and what have you, who came to South Carolina and Virginia and Mississippi and enslaved people. Mm-hmm. And you know that you're an educator who happens to have German ancestry or English ancestry. Would you be comfortable telling a classroom full of black students, hey, my people enslaved your people for 500 years and ABC? Like, you know, you don't want to have that conversation. So you just say, look, you know, slavery
probably
happened.
Not.
That, you know, exactly.
Yeah,
and
just,
now
I read yesterday Emmanuel Macron, the president of France. He says, no, we're not taking down the statues in France that actually go back to the times of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not going to expunge their history. Not because they want to, they're adulating the history the way it sounded when he spoke. So I heard him speak, but maybe he doesn't realize that, or he thinks it doesn't conflate these two issues, but they probably do. Because these people that were slave traders were glorified. And so who knows? The French were involved, the Dutch were involved, the Germans, the Italians, the Portuguese, Spanish, the English.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that was happening. Hey, even the Arabs, they were the ones that sold blacks into slavery. A lot of people don't
slavery
know
was that. Slavery was big business, and you cannot talk about the black experience in America without talking about slavery. And that's a conversation that so many people get uncomfortable about and so many people don't want to have. And that's what it needs to.
Why?
You know,
I mean, I understand that it might be painful, but there's a lot of stuff that's painful. We're not going to get anywhere if we can't discuss it.
And that's the point. And we live in a time and have lived in a time where people rather not discuss things, especially in a public school sector. Because now, Hezzy, take with the fact that coupled with now you have standardized testing, and then you have, you know, so now you have to have students prepared and have to have a certain amount of knowledge in this, and this to pass this exam. Because if the students don't pass the exam, then the teacher's looked at as a bad person because your students are failing the state test, so you're an ineffective teacher.
Uh-huh.
You don't want to be an ineffective teacher, so you're not really trying to teach too much. It's not in the curriculum. Society said teachers aren't teaching what they should, so we're going to give you a scripted curriculum, so only teach this.
Mm-hmm.
You have some school textbooks now that are so scripted, they say what the teacher should be saying to students. So at this point of the lesson, say this to your students. And then they might give one of these responses and then say this to your students. So, you know, it needs to be changed from the inside out. And people aren't willing to do that because the big thing is, oh, well, this is how it's always been done. So that's what we'll do. And, you know, that's not right.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, well, hopefully we can continue this conversation and get more in-depth and more visceral about it so that there should be no timidity in our language and just deal with the reality and hopefully that we can move the equation a little bit forward. I really would love to see more people of color teaching. I just don't know where they are. Because I don't see them being hired. But then I don't know if there's no one to hire. But I can't imagine there's nobody to hire.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? The nation, the population of the nation, I don't know what the population of the African-American is in America. Do you?
25%?
15%?
Not off the
top. I have no idea.
Head, but I do know that, again, statewide, there are 1.9% of teachers who are black men. And that's in most districts, not all. There are still districts in the state of New York. There are still districts in the state of New York that you can go to and they don't have any black men teaching in their schools.
Well, is there a reluctance by black men to go into teaching, or we don't know that?
I would say it is, and we can use my experience as an example. I substitute taught in many of the schools throughout Yonkers. And if I wasn't as strong as I was, I would have left and decided to go into another career because there are so many microaggressions There's so much racism and so much prejudice that I encounter just as a substitute teacher that it would make you sick to even want to continue to be in the room. Is he the janitor, and is he the new bus monitor, and are you the bus monitor? I mean, the constant microaggressions, and the, well, what school did you go to? Where are you from? And why aren't you teaching like this? And why aren't you teaching like that? Or who are you? And you know, it's constant, and it's every day.
Really?
And and I'm a substitute teacher. I'm not even one who can say I've been in the field teaching in my own room for 10, 15, 20, 30 years. So if I've encountered that in the months that I've substitute taught in White Plains and in Yonkers, then why in the hell would I want to continue a career like this for 30 years where some schools don't treat it as if their staff and faculty,
well,
they treat it like a sorority?
Well, sometimes you have to surmount that for the better good, especially if you want kids to learn more than they have. If they look up to a black man who is a teacher, even better.
Which is beautiful.
Or black
for
women.
Me. Yeah, which is beautiful. But at the end of the day, you know, your mental health is everything. So
hard
what
life.
Does it mean that you're in it to teach children, yet you have to deal with a full-on faculty and staff full of people who really don't want you to succeed? Or, you know, majority of
I hear you.
You know what I mean? So it's like, why even enter a profession like that, where so many of us, Hezzy, of color, have been miseducated in the school system anyway? Why would you go back to the same place that you've been miseducated, or the same place that you have so much trauma? You wouldn't want to go back to that. You'd say, you know what? I'm done and I'm moving
on. No. Yeah, I guess so. That's the way people are, and I understand that. Unbelievable. Well, any last words that you have to say? First of all, how do people get the book? After all this verbosity. Yeah, how do people get the book?
You can go and get the book. He Spoke of My School, An Educational Journey, on Amazon. The Kindle version and everything will be available very soon for those who are into ebooks. However, you can go right on Amazon and pick up the book, He Spoke of My School, An Educational Journey.
Well, that's fantastic. All right, so what are you doing now? So is this part of your career now, reaching out and teaching and getting people to realize their options in education?
Well, definitely. You know, since undergrad, I made it my mission to be an advocate for historically black institutions across the country, because you need advocates for these institutions, just like you need advocates for all schools. You know, that's why people put stickers and what have you on their cars or where they went. You know, you advocate for your school, you talk about it, you want people to know. So yes, that is now, that's been a part of what I do. But I guess, Hezzy, I can say I'm an author now for real, because it's I'm an author. It's you know, it's a new hat.
Exactly.
Absolutely. New hat.
One thing I realize, I think it's everywhere, but, certainly America impressed me, that when you go to a particular school, the difference between one school and another may not be the education that you can be afforded or that you could study up on, even beyond whatever is taught in your classroom, if you're that interested, and hopefully people are. But the difference between one school and the next is really the what do you call the people that are the alumni? The alumni, they're the ones that really are your network for getting a job. And it's through the alumni that you have access, and they say, oh, well, if you went to this school, we're the alumni from that school, and you can reach out to them, and they may help you get a job in medicine or in the legal profession or in the teaching profession, because they have awareness of how to go through that process. Do these particularly black schools, do they have that same concept of an alumni? And are they supported as well? Because that's probably the first place to go if you want to get a job.
So all colleges in this country that still grant degrees and are still graduating students have alumni bases. And yes, HBCUs have alumni bases, but, you know, in closing about HBCUs,
yeah,
not only do they have alumni bases, but historically Black colleges and universities don't just create Black students who graduate from college and then don't do anything. Historically Black colleges and universities only create Black students who are going to go on to be the best and the brightest. For an example, Toni Morrison, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Oprah Winfrey, Spike Lee, Wanda Sykes, Thurgood Marshall, and the list goes on for so many people. Randy Jackson, Lionel Richie, Roberta Flack, you know, Mike, David Banner, Will Packer, Bobby Valentino, Tony Braxton, Keisha Knight, Pulliam, 2 Chainz, Lance Gross, Terrence J, Alice Walker. I mean, only the best and the brightest come out of these institutions. Not that Black people aren't coming out of other institutions, best and bright, but yes, the alumni bases at HBCUs is so powerful and important that even though I've graduated from an HBCU in 2017, I still have the passion that I have for them to this very day, and I will always have that passion because they taught me about me, and that's powerful when
that's
you know
terrific.
Who you are.
Absolutely. Yep. That's the name of the game. Well, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your making the time. You know, I'm glad that you were able to keep on going. I didn't realize the time has flown by. It's almost an hour later.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So all the best.
Thank
and
you.
Are
Thank
you,
you.
You already have a second book are you thinking about or you're not ready for that yet? That could be next week or next month.
Imagine. I'm not sure about a second book yet, but I do know that I will be ready for a second conversation. So,
okay.
You know.
All right. We'll have
Definitely.
To do that then. Excellent. Thank you very Definitely. Much. All the best to you.
Thank you. You take care.
You too. Right. Be well.
All right.
Wow. What a pleasure. So, well, I guess the good thing is you can pick up Dennis's book. He spoke at my school, An Educational Journey. He advises that it's available through Amazon, and so that's encouraging. And I think the book was first made available on Amazon on Friday. So be very, very interesting. Just the whole idea of the compendium of work that he's put into the book, which lists the different universities and colleges that are available out there and the type of educational direction that you can go. So, you know, from every conceivable specialty. And so it is a meal ticket in more ways than one. It's a meal ticket for your mind and it's a meal ticket for your pocketbook. If you can consider focusing on that. And if it's more comfortable, certainly it seems as far as Dennis is concerned that the educational comparison is just that. It's a comparison, but there's heft on both sides of the equation of color and not of color. So that's very compelling as well. So if you feel more comfortable having a Black teacher or a Hispanic teacher or another person of color, you know, teach, then that's great. Whatever is comfortable for you, as long as you're able and willing to get that education, that seems to be the way to go. All right, let's take a quick break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. In case you do want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, and we hope you do, they have a new number, but the number is one number for their office, for their cell, for their text, and for their voicemail capacity. So reach them at 347-415-4326, 347-415-4326. Well, we're now going to be moving on into what else is happening around the world, and there's a lot of stuff that is really quite compelling, which is very, very new, and I'd only read about it earlier this morning. It seems that common steroid reduces COVID-19 fatalities by one-third. That's what United Kingdom or English researchers have said. So researchers in England say that they have the first evidence that a drug can improve COVID-19 survival. A cheap, widely available steroid called dexamethasone reduced deaths by up to one-third in severely ill hospitalized patients. Results were announced today, and researchers said they would publish them soon. The study is a large, strict test that randomly assigned 2,104 patients to get the drug and compared them, 1,321 patients getting only usual care. The drug was given either orally or through an IV, intravenous. After 28 days, it had reduced deaths by 35% in patients who needed treatment with breathing machines and by 20% in those only needing supplemental oxygen. It did not appear to help less ill patients. This is an extremely welcome result, one study leader by the name of Peter Horby of the University of Oxford in England said in a statement. Quote, the survival benefit is clear and large in those patients who are sick enough to require oxygen treatment. So dexamethasone should now become standard of care in these patients. Dexamethasone is inexpensive, on the shelf, and can be used immediately to save lives worldwide. Even though the drug only helps in severe cases, countless lives will be saved globally, said Nick Kammack, C-A-M-M-A-C-K, of Wellcome, W-E-L-L-C-O-M-E. It's a British charity that supports science research. Dexamethasone must now be rolled out and accessed by thousands of critically ill patients around the world, said Kammack, who had no role in the study. Quote, it is highly affordable, easy to make, can be scaled up quickly, and only needs small dosage. Steroid drugs reduce inflammation, which sometimes develops in COVID-19 patients as the immune system overreacts to fight the infection. The overreaction can prove fatal, so doctors have been testing steroids and other anti-inflammatory drugs in such patients. The World Health Organization, WHO, advises against using steroids earlier in the course of illness because they can slow the time until patients clear the virus. Researchers estimated that the drug would prevent one death for every 8 patients treated while on breathing machines and one for every 25 patients on extra oxygen alone. This is the same study that earlier this month showed the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine was not working against the coronavirus. The study enrolled more than 11,000 patients in England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland who were given either standard of care or that plus one of several treatments, dexamethasone, the HIV combo drug, lopinavir, ritonavir, the antibiotic azithromycin, the anti-inflammatory drug docetaxel, and or plasma from people who had recovered from COVID-19 that contains antibodies to fight the virus. Research is continuing on the other treatments. The research is funded by government health agencies in the United Kingdom and private donors, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
unbelievable. They seem to be all over the world doing as much as they can to do good. Unbelievable, really, when you come to think of it. Okay. Now, let's just look and see what else is happening. One second here. One second. Very interesting as well. This is from Germany. A far-right suspects are going on trial for the murder of a German pro-migrant politician. A German court begins hearing the case today against two far-right extremists accused of killing a regional politician whose execution-style slaying shocked the country last year. Walter Lübcke, a member of the Chancellor Angela Merkel's party, who led the regional administration in the Kassel area of central Germany, was shot on his porch on June 1 of 2019 and died later that night. Stefan Ernst, a 46-year-old with previous convictions for violent anti-migrant crimes, is accused of murder, attempted murder, serious bodily harm, and firearms offenses. A second man identified only as Markus H. In Europe, they only give the first initial of the last name. So Markus H., because of privacy rules, is charged with being an accessory to murder and breaking firearms laws. Lines formed late Monday outside the Frankfurt Regional Court, where the trial is taking place amid heightened security precautions. Restrictions due to the coronavirus epidemic mean only a small number of reporters and members of the public will be able to witness the trial. Now, prosecutors say that Ernst and Markus H. both attended an October 2015 town hall event where Lübcke defended the German government's decision to allow hundreds of thousands of refugees into the country. A video of Lübcke's remarks was widely shared in far-right circles, drawing numerous threats. Federal prosecutor Dieter Kilmer said that Ernst was motivated by racism and xenophobia. Now, both suspects sought, quote, an ethnically, culturally homogeneous society, said Kilmer. In January 2016, Ernst allegedly stabbed an Iraqi asylum seeker in the back, injuring the victim's spine and severing two nerves. And police only linked him to the racially motivated stabbing after finding the knife used in his possession when he was arrested for Lübcke's slaying last June. Authorities discovered numerous illegal firearms that Ernst had stored in various locations, including three revolvers, two pistols, two rifles, and a submachine gun, as well as 1,400 bullets. Ernst initially told investigators he carried out the killing alone, but later retracted his claim. Trial, Lübcke's wife and two sons will present as co-plaintiffs, as permitted by German law. I'm convinced that it was a cold-blooded, insidious, cowardly murder with vicious motives, Holger Matt, a lawyer for the Lübcke family, told reporters outside the court. German government vowed to crack down on far-right extremism following the Lübcke killing and other attacks last year, warning that it poses a significant security threat in the country. The trial is scheduled to last until at least October. So, my goodness, there's so much that's going on. Now, let me just quickly look and see what else is happening. And this is very important, too. In Asia, there are a lot of issues today. Troops have been killed in a violent clash on the India-China border. Three Indian soldiers were killed in a violent face-off on the Chinese border, the Indian Army said today, following weeks of rising tensions and the deployment of thousands of extra troops from both sides. Brawls erupt regularly between the two nuclear-armed giants across their disputed 2,200-mile frontier, but no one has been killed in decades. But the Indian Army said there were casualties on both sides in Monday's incident on the Himalayan frontier between China's Tibet and India's region of Ladakh, although Beijing made no mention of any while laying the blame squarely on Delhi. A violent face-off took place yesterday, Monday, night, with casualties on both sides. The loss of lives on the Indian side includes an officer and two soldiers, an Indian Army spokesman said in a statement. Well, senior military officials of the two sides are currently meeting at the venue to defuse the situation. An Indian Army officer in the region told Agence France-Presse that there has been no shooting in the incident on precipitous rocky terrain in the strategically important Galwan Valley. It was violent hand-to-hand scuffles, the officer said, on condition of anonymity. Beijing on Tuesday confirmed a clash took place but made no mention of casualties. It did accuse Indian soldiers of crossing into Chinese territory and attacking Chinese personnel. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian said that Indian troops, quote, crossed the borderline twice, provoking and attacking Chinese personnel, resulting in serious physical confrontation between border forces on two sides. We again solemnly request that India follows the relevant attitude and restrains its frontline troops, he said. On May 9, several Indian and Chinese soldiers were injured in a clash involving fists and stone throwing at Nakula in India's Sikkim state, which borders Bhutan, Nepal, and China. I was in Sikkim because I crossed over from Nepal. Anyway, on May 9, several Indian and Chinese soldiers were injured in a clash involving fists and stone throwing. Oh, I read that to you already. But the Chinese Foreign Ministry said only last week that a positive consensus had been reached following effective communication through diplomatic and military channels. In a later statement, India's Foreign Ministry said the two sides would continue the military and diplomatic engagements to resolve the situation and to ensure peace and tranquility in the border areas. However, Indian sources and news reports suggested that Chinese troops remained in parts of the Galwan Valley and of the northern shore of the Pangong So Lake that it occupied in recent weeks. Well, and India and China have never even agreed on how long their line of actual control frontier is. And each side uses different frontier proposals made by Britain to China in the 19th century to back their claims. India gives a figure of 3,500 kilometers or 2,175 miles. China does not give a number, but state media says the border should be just 2,000 kilometers or 1,250 miles when China's claims in Jammu, Kashmir, Ladakh, and other regions are taken into account. Well, relations between China and India have long been prickly. They fought a brief war in 1962 in which China took territory from India. Further deadly clashes followed in 67 into the disputed Doklam Peninsula on the China-India-Bhutan border. After that, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Chinese leader Xi Jinping sought to ease tensions at summits. Alice Wells, the top U.S. State Department official for both South Asia and last month that China was seeking to upset the regional balance and had to be resisted. And U.S. President Donald Trump also offered to mediate, but both countries sidestepped the other. So we'll see where that goes. If it goes anywhere, probably won't go anywhere. Okay, so bear with me a moment. Let me just see here. Yes, we posted this up early this morning. Evidently, North Korea has blown up an inter-Korean liaison office. North Korea blew up an inter-Korean liaison office on its side of the border on Tuesday after days of increasingly virulent rhetoric from Pyongyang. The demolition came after Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, said at the weekend that the, quote, useless North-South Joint Liaison Office, end quote, would soon be seen, quote, completely collapsed, end quote. Footage of the explosion released by Seoul's presidential Blue House showed a blast rolling across several buildings just across the border, Kaesong, with a nearby tower partially collapsing as clouds of smoke rose into the sky. Analysts say that Pyongyang may be seeking to manufacture a crisis to increase pressure on Seoul, while nuclear negotiations with Washington are at a stalemate. After an emergency meeting, National Security Council said that it would, quote, react strongly, end quote, if Pyongyang, quote, continues to take steps to aggravate the situation, end quote. All responsibility for repercussions stemming from this action falls squarely on the North, it added. The liaison office in a dormant industrial zone where southern companies once employed northern workers was opened in September of 2018, days before the South President Moon Jae-in flew to Pyongyang for his third summit with Kim. Around 2,000 officials from each side were stationed in the office during subsequent months, but inter-Korean relations soured following the collapse of the Hanoi summit between Kim and the United States President Donald Trump in February last year over sanctions relief and what the North would be willing to give up in return. So operations at the office were suspended in January because of coronavirus pandemic. So there's a lot going on, as they say. Let's just quickly look. Well, let's find out what's going on. The United States is going to slash the number of American troops in Germany. That's what Trump says. So President Donald Trump on Monday said that the U.S. will slash the number of troops stationed in Germany by roughly 9,500 to 25,000 people, significantly reducing U.S. commitments to European defense under NATO in what former U.S. military commander said would be a gift. So that's what he said would be a gift to Russia's Vladimir Putin. Trump said in comments to reporters that Germany does not spend enough to defense as required by the NATO alliance. He said that until Germany spends more, the United States will remove its troops. My goodness. Well, let's take a quick break, find out what else is going on in our neck of the woods. And we'll give you a moment. Here we are.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge.
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show.
Cabot Rules.
The Stanley Cup.
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, welcome back. It's about 11:20 at the moment. We are so backlogged with so many things to post. That just the extra 40 minutes today will work out great. The news will cover more of it tomorrow. So we'll see what else happens. We have a full day tomorrow, so we have about 1.5 hours, and then I'll be able to spend the last half hour with you on some national and international news. So it's just limitless. It just goes on and on. And today, even today, started like at 5:30 in the morning, and I'm still backlogged. So we'll speak to you tomorrow. Have a great day, and thanks for joining us today. Be well, and goodbye.